Hey, folks, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. There's a lot more to this show. With impeachment coming, with the election coming up, you're going to want to hear all of it, folks. It's easy to do. Become a member at ROFpodcast.com. When you do, you're supporting the free show and we're giving you extra content. Not to mention, you get access to over our 10 years of worth of archives. Are you kidding me? This is a deal, folks. Do it now, ROFpodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, Ken Klippenstein from the Young Turks Investigates will tell us about a bizarre story involving a rogue Marine who left his post with heavy weapons and what he was planning to do. Paul Waldman from the American Prospect will join us to explain why we should treat Donald Trump's impeachment hearings like a five-alarm fire. Heather Digby Parton will be here to help me run down an important week in the news. And our progressive candidate spotlight this week will be with Michaela Wilkes. She's running against incumbent Steny Hoyer in Maryland's 5th District. If you're listening to the radio right now, you should know that there's a free one-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. There's also a member show, and you can support Ring of Fire Radio by becoming a member and getting our three-hour radio show without commercials, with access to all of our archives over the past 10 years. You can go to ROFpodcast.com to sign up. Help me run down a busy week in the news. Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, this week we have a lot to talk about. Of course, the UN is having a massive meeting, or had, this week. About that was focused largely on climate change, highlighted by protests that took place at the beginning of the week that were inspired by Greta Thunberg, the 16-year-old girl from Sweden who basically took a boat across the Atlantic to draw attention to the inaction by the world leaders on a catastrophe that we are all facing as a species in many respects. The UAW strike continues. It is now in almost a week old at this point, a little more, and 48,000 auto workers on strike. It's a massive strike. We may be seeing one from the Chicago teachers shortly as well. Obviously, we've got some polling in the 2020 race. Things seem to be on the move there as people start to tune into the Democratic primary. But the big news, of course, this week is that the dynamic has turned on the question of impeachment. And I think by any measure, we have now crossed the Rubicon. Nancy Pelosi came out earlier in the week, announced formal impeachment inquiry proceedings beginning. We're still looking at maybe some of the what the structure is going to be, but this is really a new era for the Trump presidency, isn't it?
I think so, and you know, frankly, it's overdue. I think that the new era. I think a lot of us thought that new era began in January when the Democrats took over the House. And that it wouldn't take, you know, it wouldn't take much for it, us to have gotten here, at least when the Mueller report was released last spring. So the fact that it's taken a while, you know, is unfortunate, but nonetheless, we are here, and it appears from what you can see since Monday, the number of Democrats that were in favor of impeachment investigation, an official impeachment investigation, went from 134 to, at last count, as far as I know, was well over 200, perhaps over 210, with some of the holdouts, by the way, being, people you clearly are going to vote for impeachment. They're doing it for strategic reasons, to have some votes to spare there. If and when it gets to the point where they're voting on impeachment, these people can come in and to be the last holdout, so that some of the swing voters are the ones that are in moderate districts or whatever, Trump districts. If they vote for impeachment, they won't be the last ones. And I think that's just normal kind of strategizing in terms of votes and whipping the caucus. So it's actually probably much closer.
In other words, just to be clear, that it's more than likely there are enough votes to impeach today, essentially, in terms of, right. of how it's committed. I mean, obviously, the Democrats want to follow a process, and part of that process, I would imagine, would be also to, make the American public fully on board with this and be aware of it. But certainly, it seems highly unlikely that we're going to get to the end of this process and the House is not going to vote to impeach Donald Trump.
That's correct. And I think that's probably been there for a while, although reporting does suggest that there were these what they call frontline, freshmen who are, had been sort of holding out. But over the last couple of months, there's been apparently some rethinking of that. This latest, of course, this revelation that Trump was basically blackmailing the Ukrainian president into digging up dirt or manufacturing dirt on Joe Biden, in exchange for military aid, which he was withholding at the time, which Trump was withholding at the time. The revelation of that, this whistleblower that came forward, and then the release of the memo sort of memorializing that conversation, certainly did, change the dynamics to the point where I think that Democrats finally realized that there is no avoiding it. I mean, I'm not sure I ever understood why they thought they should. They had some political reasons for that, thinking they'd lose the House or something. But it's been clear to most of us, I think, for a long time that there was no avoiding this. And not just because of this particular thing, although it's amazing that he did this. He made this call to the Ukrainian president the day after the Mueller testimony, and even mentioned the Mueller testimony in the call, saying that it was all a witch hunt, et cetera, clearly feeling liberated, believing he'd gotten away with it, and so essentially went and did exactly the same thing that he had been suspected of doing in 2016, which Mueller couldn't prove because he couldn't prove, quote, willfulness, meaning that he couldn't prove they didn't know that they knew what they were doing, and in campaign finance violations, which that apparently would have been at the time, there has to be some sense that they know what they're doing. Well, there's no excuse for that now, obviously, because Trump is the president. He's been through the full Mueller investigation. He knows very well he can't do that. That's considered unethical. But having been exonerated in his mind, he felt he could just go ahead and do this. That really is a bridge too far. And there's another aspect to this, and that is the fact that he and his henchmen in the White House counsel's office and in the Department of Justice have determined that he can also get away with total obstruction of Congress. And that is also an impeachable offense. Richard Nixon, one of the articles of impeachment against him was obstruction of Congress. So between those two things, I think that finally pushed the Democrats over the edge, and they realized that they had to take this step, and perhaps even realized that this was not as politically risky as they thought, because at some point or another, you have to recognize that, there were a lot of Democrats out there, 70% and growing, that wanted this. At some point, these people all had to look over their shoulder and realize, well, gee, maybe I'm losing more people than I'm gaining, right, especially in those districts. And that's a risky proposition. So, it finally came to a head. And it's still unfolding and will continue to unfold for a while, I think. I don't think this is going to be resolved immediately, although there has been some discussion that, well, let's get this impeachment thing over with, which is ridiculous. But I don't think that can happen. There's too much. There's just too much, to deal with.
Well, let's take a break and talk about how this should go. And also, let's talk about how it came about, what we anticipate. I think this is an important moment for the Democrats, and it was thrust upon them, at least the leadership anyways, and they had no choice. But we will talk more about that in a moment. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Be right back with Heather Parton. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he's been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder here with Digby. So, Heather, obviously we're talking about impeachment. I'm going to be talking to Paul Waldman about impeachment more in the bottom half of the hour. But obviously this is a big story, and this is going to totally change the dynamic. And what's fascinating on some level is, you know, you made the point that we anticipated this would happen in January, that at least we would lead to this. And I think, frankly, the Democrats have been able to dodge a bullet of some to some extent, that because they had not filled this vacuum that is created when they're in power, that the Trump administration or the right didn't fill it themselves. Now, I'm not convinced, and you made the point that the phone call, which has been the sort of, I guess, the straw that broke the camel's back, or at least appears to be the one, and you cited reporting Ryan Grimm in The Intercept had a piece that apparently was basically he was waiting to publish about the pressure that Nancy Pelosi was getting from those frontline Democrats. These are freshmen who are elected in districts that are either only slightly Democratic, favorable to Democrats, or slightly favorable to Republicans, known as the frontline Democrats, the ones that are theoretically most vulnerable. And apparently they went home on August recess and they were inundated by constituents who were like, you must impeach Donald Trump. That's why we elected you. And so this was happening. And then I think fortunately for everybody, this whistleblower report came up. We haven't even fully seen the whistleblower report, but I imagine we will soon. Comes up and falls into Nancy Pelosi's lap and becomes sort of the catalyst, at least, for this reversal. And I, you know, again, after Corey Lewandowski's performance last week, I think the momentum was already headed there. And I think it's not a coincidence, like you said, the day after the phone call between the Trump and the president from Ukraine happened the day after the Mueller report, and or I should say Mueller testimony. And I think it's quite clear that that was also the day they had decided we're going to turn this around and we're going to investigate the investigators. And part of that is going to be digging up this stuff on Joe Biden. And this is they've been sort of hung in some respect by their own petard. But how do you think this should go? I mean, there are, you know, that's the other thing that I think that the Democrats, I think it's an absolutely necessity. I think once they vote for impeachment, they are at the very least they have done what the American public asked of them to do to some degree. But I would be worried if they did it too quickly. I feel like they can't totally bungle it, but they can bungle it, can't they?
You bet. And there, I mean, there is discussion of, you know, well, let's do this. You know, this is the one. This is the impeachable offense. Let's deal with that. We'll get that vote, and then, you know, we'll move on. Well, you know, that's not going to be good enough, because what Trump has done, I mean, this is an entire, you know, systematic sort of assault on presidential norms and rules and laws. I mean, you know, the Mueller report itself had 10 instances of potential obstruction of justice, which are pretty clear that should be dealt with. And you know, they don't have to do a lot with that. He did all the legwork and the investigation, but they do have to lay that out, and that needs to be part of any impeachment proceeding. There's also the corruption in office, which I think is terribly important. You can't just let that pass. You can't just say, well, you know, that maybe that wasn't impeachable. I mean, once you've opened this can of worms, you kind of have to look at it in a holistic way, because it isn't just this election interference, although that is certainly, you know, that's kind of the original sin, right, of the Trump campaign and Trump's organization. But there are all these other things that he has shown, that he's exposed these weaknesses in the system, and these weaknesses must be shored up. And there's no way to do that, not really, if they do not, you know, take this up in impeachment. Now, some of the impeachment counts may not actually, you know, get a majority. That happened in the Nixon situation. There were some that came up. There was one about his taxes. There was a couple of them that they didn't get a majority out of the Judiciary Committee. But that doesn't matter. You know, that doesn't exonerate him. It just says that they were, you know, unable to, quote, prove the case. They need to do these things. I mean, this is important. And by the way, it isn't that hard. You know, there's a lot of documentation of what's been going on. I mean, this idea that somehow or another it's just overwhelming to, you know, to get the investigation. We've got to get people to come up here and testify, and the White House won't let us, and we don't have the documents and all that. Those are excuses. There's plenty of information out there that they have access to. Now, granted, you know, holding hearings has a dramatic factor. They're useful. I think in what you said earlier about Corey Lewandowski, his, you know, absolutely contemptuous attitude toward the Congress, I think that contributed to the fact that Donald Trump is going to be impeached. You can imagine Rudy Giuliani doing something like that. I mean, these are useful, but they're not required. I mean, they have a lot of evidence already. So, in any case, what there was talk of Pelosi naming a you know, select committee like they had in the Senate in Watergate. But she decided not to do that, largely on the basis of her progressive members, from what I understand, standing up and saying absolutely not, because they were afraid that this was going to be sort of siloed into one narrow,
right,
narrow impeachment count. And instead, she agreed, you know, facing a rebellion in her troops, to allow the six committees, which I, you know, it's oversight, ways and means, foreign relations, intelligence, judiciary, and finance, that all of them could continue their investigations and would report their findings to the Judiciary Committee. So that's now, where the central sort of gathering place will be.
This is going to be important. We're going to talk to Paul Waldman when we come back, and you and I will continue this conversation in parallel in the next hour. I'm Sam Seder, Ring of Fire Radio. Be right back with Paul Waldman. Digby will join me in the next hour. Just ahead, Paul Waldman on the importance of impeachment hearings. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop.
use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
Hey, folks. It's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he's been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. This week, impeachment proceedings formally began against Donald Trump after information from a whistleblower was released outlining details of a call held between Trump and the president of the Ukraine. Here to explain why this impeachment should be treated like a five-alarm fire, Paul Waldman from the American Prospect. So, Paul, these are interesting times.
Indeed they are.
We have finally crossed the threshold of impeachment. There was a sense that this was, I guess this was to be expected. I think people anticipated it happening earlier, frankly. Just give me your broad overview about, like, you know, the timing of this. Does it matter that it's maybe some people feel it's a little late? Certainly, according to reporting that I've seen, it seems like this was building since the August recess.
Yeah, and there's an interesting kind of dynamic going on within the Democratic Party. There was a good article by Ryan Grimm in The Intercept talking about the sort of tensions between the more progressive members and some of even some moderates who felt like they were getting increasing pressure from their constituents, that it was really building, that there was a lot of frustration, feeling like Democrats were ineffectual. And that was about not just impeachment, but a whole lot of things that, you know, things like the fact that we have not yet seen Donald Trump's tax returns, and the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee seemed to be sort of slow walking that whole process. There was this building sense among Democratic voters that, you know, you have this kind of lawless president who is just refusing to respond to subpoenas, who was sort of walking all over them, and Democrats didn't seem to be doing anything about it. And so that pressure was really building, I think, and I think there was a lot of grassroots organizing that was having an effect of, you know, creating the sense among Democratic members that their constituents were not happy because they're getting all those phone calls and emails and people pressuring them about it. And so that sort of laid the groundwork as that was building. Once you had this story come out about this phone call with the president of Ukraine, it just burst. And it's interesting is when we go back and look at this and through the lens of history, you're going to see all these little signal events. I think one of the big ones was the op-ed that was published in the Washington Post the other day by a group of Democratic freshmen who had been among the holdouts. They're from more moderate districts. They're people who have experience in either the military or the intelligence community, and they came out and supported an impeachment inquiry. And you immediately saw all of these reporters on Capitol Hill using the phrase, the dam has burst. That really was kind of the final straw, that once those people said, those members who were resistant before said, okay, now we too support an impeachment inquiry, that was really kind of the final straw. And then, of course, that was even before we saw the whatever version of the transcript that the White House actually released, which appears to be heavily redacted, but is still incredibly incriminating. And at that point, you know, there was just no question anymore.
Yeah, it's interesting to me how this was really one of those things where Nancy Pelosi would not get off the dime until it was almost 100% locked in. And even then, there seems to be a tremendous amount of reluctance, which, how do you explain that, right? I mean, I have a different opinion as to the efficacy of it politically. I certainly thought that the necessity to do this for the sake, frankly, of the country, it may sound a little corny. It's not usually the way I talk, but you need to hold, if you couldn't hold Donald Trump to account, I don't know why we have impeachment. I don't know who you could. But even if you put that aside for a moment from the political calculus that Nancy Pelosi was making, right, presumably it was like these frontline, so-called frontline Democrats, they understand their districts better than you do in Brooklyn. And so, you know, we need to honor them and protect them. Well, when they come back from recess and say, like, we got to do this because we're getting hammered by this. Why doesn't Nancy Pelosi sort of like go full on in? Why does she need to be? There's still a sense of like this is being done sort of kicking and screaming.
Yeah, you know, I think that, and I say this as somebody who has great respect for Pelosi and has written lots of things complimentary toward her. I think that there's a degree to which she still thinks about a conception of congressional politics that is no longer true. If you look over the last few elections, what we're seeing is that congressional elections are getting more and more nationalized. And so there have been analyses that political scientists have done showing that the correlation between the presidential vote in a current congressional district and the vote for Congress is getting more and more complete. And so, you know, 20, 30 years ago, you had lots of members who Democrats who got elected in Republican districts and vice versa. And, you know, you could, as one of those members, you know, set a more moderate course, be a little different from your party, and you'd be rewarded for it by your constituents. But that's really no longer true. We're now in a situation, for a few different reasons, where voters are seeing their own congressional elections in their districts in a national context. And if you think about it, that makes perfect sense. If I am a Democrat and I would prefer to have Democrats control Congress, but my congressman is a Republican and I think he's a nice guy, should I vote for him or should I vote for the Democrat? Because that'll make it more likely that the Democrats will then take over Congress. Well, even if he's maybe bringing home some things for the district and you think he's a good guy, it actually makes more sense for you to vote in a kind of a national view. And more voters are thinking about it that way. But I think that Pelosi still sees a lot more variation in what members of Congress can get away with or should be able to get away with. And she has become so focused on those frontline members and sees them as the key to keeping a hold on the majority. And, you know, of course, there's a degree to which that's true. You know, there's no question that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is going to get reelected. And it's much more uncertain for, you know, somebody who comes from a marginal district where they're really going to have to fight and it's going to be close. But there's been a question of, is that member going to win by being more moderate? Or are they going to win because the Democratic Party as a whole is more energized? And so, you know, this is the same argument that we've been having for a while. But as you said, even these frontline members, they went back to their districts and they were getting an earful from constituents saying, why isn't this guy being impeached yet? And they were feeling the pressure and they came back and said, you know, we have to do this too. So, you know, there's a kind of a national dynamic to every congressional race that I think has taken hold. You know, the old saying was that all politics is local. Well, now it really seems that all politics is national.
I mean, I think that is the case. And, you know, when I look back at when the Democrats took the House for the last two times they've taken the House, one was back in 2006. You'll recall, and that race was also nationalized, right? The story of corruption, that sort of coalesced around the idea that, you know, I mean, I think we like to look back and think about it as the war, but I remember in real time that being very, very much about Mark Foley and about the Republican leadership in the House protecting a guy who had been sort of predatory around congressional pages. To the point where I think like the whip, the Republican whip went out, I think he was from Buffalo at the time, went out for a press briefing and surrounded himself with young children so that they couldn't ask questions about that. And and that became like a sort of a national phenomenon. And of course, I think in 2018, all the data points to people who distanced themselves, who went after Donald Trump, even in these purple districts. Or even reddish districts did much better running against Donald Trump. And this seems to me to be a turnkey run against Donald Trump. Even if you're in, some congressional seat in Iowa, you're running against Donald Trump because your opponent will have taken a very explicit position on whether Donald Trump should be held to account. We need to take a quick break, but I want to get, when we come back, I want to ask you about what you think the best way to do this is, because it's one thing to decide that Donald Trump is going to be impeached. It's another to decide that we're going to do it in a way that has the most resonance. We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Seder, Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back with Paul Waldman after this. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours pouring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Back on Ring of Fire Radio, I'm Sam Seder. Right now, I'm talking to Paul Waldman about his piece in The American Prospect, The Crisis is Now. So, Paul, we've talked about in the last segment, you know, how this impeachment came about, and frankly, sort of that it has, in many respects, revealed, and you cited Ryan Grimm's reporting, and I think, frankly, everybody seems to be citing this reporting. He was he has been on this sort of beat about how Democratic politics have been playing out in the House for quite some time. He just wrote a book about it as well. And, you know, it's been fascinating to watch this because as he laid it out in a story that was more or less, I think, reported out before Nancy Pelosi decided to pull the trigger on impeachment, part of the dynamic was a fight between the moderates and the so-called squad and the freshman congresspeople who are not just more, progressive in some ways, but more partisan, which are not necessarily the same things, of course. And I just remember, Nancy Pelosi rolling out H.R. 1, which I thought was a pretty ambitious bill, and I could understand the theory behind it. But they also got bogged down in going after Ilhan Omar at that time. And nobody paid attention to H.R. 1. It was all this story about the Democratic leadership going after Ilhan Omar. Do you think that, in addition to all the implications of that we're seeing with impeachment, that we're seeing a fundamental shift in a dynamic within the Democratic Party in the House?
You know, I think it's possible, and I think there's probably a good deal of resentment toward the squad and other young members who, you know, come in and have a different style of politics and get all this attention. And I'm sure that, that members who have been around for a while are thinking, you know, how come I'm not, you know, on TV every night and on the cover of magazines?
And the number three fundraiser in the Democratic caucus. I mean, she's raised more money than just about anybody in the caucus.
Yeah, so I think that that has something to do with it. And I think there's still, you know, persists a somewhat naive belief that, you know, you often hear people say, well, you know, we just need to stick to kitchen table issues and show the public that we have good ideas that will improve their lives. And as you say, you know, that's all good. It's good to, you know, think about those issues and lay down things like HR 1 so that you know what you want to do once you actually have the chance. But there's a naive belief that that will actually get you some kind of credit that people will ever know. But the reality is that, that that's going to pass by without notice by most people. But once you have some kind of, you know, dramatic intra-party conflict like you did with the stuff about Ilhan Omar, that's going to suck up all the attention because we have a media system that is, that goes toward conflict like moth to a flame. So, you know, I never really understand why professional politicians think that they're going to get any kind of degree of attention for their, you know, substantive, meaningful, important bills. As I say, like, that's something that, that the Democratic Party should do during this period, but it's mostly because they need to prepare themselves for when they actually have power. So if you, you know, they've already written HR 1 and it has lots of nice reforms in it. And so, you know, if they get a Democratic president elected and they have control of Congress, then that is ready to go on day one, and that's great. But it's not going to get you a whole lot of credit in the meantime. So, you know, those are, I think that, that in many ways, people like Ocasio-Cortez are much more in tune to the way politics works now. And, you know, a lot in many ways for better, in some ways for worse, but they understand it. And so that's part of the reason why they get the attention that they do.
We have about 4 minutes left. Give me a sense of how you think this should happen. We don't know exactly all the details about in terms of like timeline. There's some talk by Democrats this week that we should only focus on Ukraine as opposed to the wide litany of things that are impeachable offenses by this president. We've heard that basically the multiple committees will continue to work and refer things to the judiciary, which I think cuts against that idea that it would be just one issue. But what do you think optimally, from your perspective, would be the best way to handle this? When would it end? When would the vote take place? What would happen in between?
Well, there's two things to consider. One is whether the process can actually elicit facts that we don't already know. And it might. You know, we've seen, we're learning more facts seemingly on an hourly basis. So there's that consideration of what is it going to take to actually to get a you know, everything that we need to understand. Although, you know, a lot of it we already know. I mean, the president went on television and admitted to his impeachable conduct, as did his lawyer. So that's one part. And the other part is, you know, the reality is that this is a spectacle that you want to create. You want to be able to educate the public. You want them to understand, and you want to have something that will be on television that they can watch, and so they can have the facts laid out for them. And there are a number of different ways you can do that. You know, they had talked about having a select committee, but it seems like they've rejected that idea. You know, one hopes that it doesn't devolve into the kind of, you know, series of 5-minute little grandstandings that we see so often in committee hearings. I think it would be much better if you had some kind of professional counsel who was the one doing most of the questioning, because that always ends up producing, you know, things that are more fruitful. But a big question is, how much is the administration going to stonewall? Are they going to refuse to answer subpoenas when the committee issues them? Are they going to refuse to answer questions once they get there? Is it going to be like Corey Lewandowski every time we actually have a witness testify? I don't think we know the answer to that question yet. But the if they are, as they are now seem to be saying, going to restrict this to just the Ukraine matter, well, it seems like you could handle that pretty quickly. Wouldn't have to take months and months. I mean, it's pretty straightforward.
But why would you want to? But why would you want to?
You know, I think the rationale that they have is that this is something that it's easy for the public to understand. The misdeed is clear, and therefore, you know, we can just sort of get through that and make our case without having to bring in a whole bunch of stuff that maybe, you know, you have to teach people about, or the people, or maybe it seems less clear to people, things about emoluments and self-dealing, and we get into these arguments about, well, you know, was the Air Force actually going to go to his resort
but
anyway?
All
these things.
But why would you want this to pass?
That's their argument.
But they must have a fundamental belief in that instance that the real jeopardy is basically that the Democrats will burn themselves on this. I mean, that's the only explanation, because otherwise, I mean, if you thought the net benefit was for Democrats, you would, I don't know, drag this out till July. Like, you know, congratulations, you're impeached and you're the Republican nominee.
I think you're exactly right, and I think that it does come down to that kind of lack of faith. The Republican approach to this is just shoot in every possible direction you can, and you never know what you might hit. And it's true, because on the 8th congressional investigation of Benghazi was when they discovered that Hillary Clinton had a private email server. The 8th. And but there's a feeling among a lot of Democrats that, you know, we shouldn't really that if we really tell people what we really think, they're not going to like us. And so we have to kind of, you know, be as gentle as possible and careful. And if we're too, you know, if we are too mean to Trump, then we'll be punished for it. If we're too progressive in what we advocate, we'll be punished for it. So there's this, that is a kind of a deep-seated affliction that the Democratic Party has had for decades, that they believe that the public is always ready to punish them and ready to reject them. And I think that that's you're going to see part of that in how they end up planning these impeachment hearings.
All right. Well, Paul Waldman, I hope they listen to us and not to themselves. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks. My pleasure.
Paul Waldman is a weekly columnist and senior writer for The American Prospect. He also writes for the Plumline blog at Washington Post and The Week, and is author of Being Right Is Not Enough: What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. When we come back, Heather Parton will join me to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com to support the show and hear what you have been missing.
Your body may be gone. I'm gonna carry you in my head, in my heart, in my soul. And maybe we'll get lucky and we'll both live again. Well, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know, don't think so.
Hey, folks. It's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he's been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.